Today on Emerging Tech Horizons, U.S.-Indian technology cooperation under IndusX. Hello and welcome to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I'm Arun Serafin, Executive Director of NDIA's Emerging Technologies Institute. Today we're going to talk about U.S.-Indo defense industry cooperation and a new initiative called IndusX, or U.S.-India Defense Accelerator Ecosystem. My guest today to help explain IndusX is Dr. Samir Lalwani. Samir is a senior expert on South Asia at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's also a non-resident senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He's a term member with the Council of Foreign Relations, a contributing editor to War on the Rocks, and on the side got a PhD from MIT in political science. So please welcome and join me in welcoming Samir to today's podcast. Thanks for being here, Samir.
Thanks for having me on.
So I didn't do your bio justice, so give us a little bit more about your background and how you got to USIP. Sure. And what you're working on today.
Yeah, so I work at the U.S. Institute of Peace, which not many people know it what it is, even though we all see that building when we cross over the bridge over the Potomac. So the U.S. Institute of Peace is a quasi-federal entity established by Congress, funded by a congressional authorization, but also through interagency agreements with the executive branch. But we are not part of the executive branch. So we serve a lot of functions, some research and analytics, some convening, some trial balloon testing of ideas and engagements, but not officially part of the interagency system.
So how did your career trajectory get you there?
So I, as you mentioned, I went to graduate school at MIT, did my PhD work in political science. I spent a lot of time thinking about counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, Pakistan. That was my dissertation work, was looking at like that dynamic in South Asia. Ended up coming to DC to go to the Rand Corporation first, then the Stimson Center. Spent a lot of time looking at nuclear escalation dynamics, particularly in South Asia. And at some point when COIN sort of fell out of fashion, I started thinking more about the U.S.-India defense relationship because I'd been looking at the national security architecture on the Indian side. And that led me to a pathway of doing some of the usual think tank stuff, track twos, reports, analytic work.
What are track twos?
Track two engagements are non-government engagements with another country. So, for example, we are at our think tank would convene with former government officials from India, analysts who also work at think tanks, former military, and sometimes you'd have government attend on the sidelines that make it a track 1.5. But these were sort of informal ways of testing ideas and communicating sort of interests and challenges and opportunities. So that's the usual sort of think tank bread and butter. Occasionally, I'd sort of read out some of these reports to colleagues in the interagency, to the Pentagon, the State Department. And one of our key findings on the India side was that there was this tremendous demand for a technology partnership. And in the absence of that, the relationship was really going to start to hit a plateau. And so that was a finding. We would sort of share that. It was a diagnosis. And then at some point in the conversations with governments, the U.S. government said, well, hey, maybe you guys should think about some prescriptions for this. Like, what are the things we can do to actually solve this? And that, I think, was sort of part of the process of developing a concept like IndusX, which I don't want to take credit for. It's the U.S. government's initiative, but something that we've helped to conceptualize and develop a little bit.
So now what's your official position with IndusX?
So we have no official position. The U.S. Institute of Peace is one of the many stakeholders that's helping to support the kind of the execution of it, the conceptualization of it, the development of it. And there are industry stakeholders, non-government stakeholders, think tanks, industry organizations.
So it's more of a coordination advisory style.
Yeah, exactly. And so convening, especially because this is a process of convening these stakeholders with government to essentially figure out what the best policies are and to tinker with them. That is the role I think that USIP has been basically playing, is that convener.
Great. So we danced around it now. Yep. You're working on IndusX. So what exactly is IndusX?
So it's a mouthful. But basically, I think IndusX's objective is, and let's do an ends, ways, means approach here, right? So the ends, I think, are essentially to build greater connective tissue between the private sector, the defense technology and dual use and deep tech private sectors in India and the United States. for the objective of producing capabilities that both sides can use and then generating the requirements that would lead to those capabilities, both the R&D as well as the commercial technology developments. And that's, you know, for the sake of the technologies themselves, but also to build sort of greater bonds within the relationship. The mechanism to do that is the private sector. That sort of is seen to be sort of the new opportunity space. And then within the private sector, I think what IndusX is trying to do is to build horizontal links between the two countries and their industries, which are organized quite differently. And most of India's defense industry is actually in the public sector, but it has a nascent private sector defense industry. But then also vertical links between established primes or in India, sort of major conglomerates, and then sort of startups to small, medium enterprises that are maybe innovating from the bottom up. So I think that sort of the horizontal and vertical networks is maybe the most basic way of putting it, and then all for the purpose of building capabilities.
And so then the cooperation then, is it both at the research level and then at the manufacturing and production level?
So it is notionally aspiring to all those things. It is, and there have been in the past collaboration between our research labs, but I think they're fairly limited and it's a little more challenging to start there. So I think the greener space is in the private sector first and foremost, seeing if there are possibilities for industrial partnerships between a US prime and an Indian startup that might have a new sensor or a subsystem that prime might want to acquire and put on its platform or integrate into its system. And that can be then exported to the global market. That could be exported to the Indian government, to the US government. But I think the initial stage is sort of the private sector collaborations. And then at some point, this is backing into co-innovation, but maybe at some point we have our labs doing more, you know, bottom-up work together. And there was a process, and we can get into this later, but there was an effort at this. There's the Air Force Research Lab signed an agreement with India's Defense Research Development Organization to build an air-launched UAV. I think the agreement was signed in 2021, but the timeline for this, because we're working through bureaucratic processes that are very unfamiliar with each other, the timeline was expected to be 4 to 7 years. And that point in time, you know, innovation has sort of outpaced the research process. So I think there was a novel idea to start at the private sector first and then see if we can work backwards from there.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the past efforts at cooperation, and many of our viewers may not know about the history of U.S.-Indo cooperation in military matters. Even from someone like me coming from the Hill, I remember the stories of Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska serving during World War II in India and flying over the hump, I guess, to support operations in China. That's one example that people may not know about. How has the history of U.S.-Indian cooperation in these areas been?
Yeah, so I'd say there's been peaks and valleys. The peaks, probably the one we can point back to from 1962, India fought a war with China. And in that war, the Prime Minister of India basically, even though India was a non-aligned country, sought assistance from the United States at a really rapid pace. So the U.S. quickly ferried in military assistance to support the Indian military. And the war was going so badly for India that at some point they asked for U.S. fighter squadrons to provide air defense and force protection and probably even some close air support that they were seeking. But the war ended before the U.S. could respond to that request. But I think there was a belief, and there's some analysis in the United States, that there's a belief that President Kennedy would have authorized that. So we would have had a fairly significant military commitment, even though there already was pretty significant military assistance. Following that, we did an air defense exercise with the Indians. The original Quad was actually the U.S., the U.K., Australia, and India doing a major air defense exercise in the aftermath of that war. So that was a peak. Then there's a valley for about 20, 30 years. Cold War happens, it's ongoing. India leans towards the Soviet Union for a variety of reasons, but it sort of gets most acute in 1971 in their war with Pakistan. Coming out of the Cold War, there's a thaw in the relationship, but really sort of picks up in 2000, 2001. Bush administration opens up the relationship with a nuclear deal that kind of removes a lot of the restrictions on our engagements, particularly the export control restrictions. And then you see initiatives that are building in defense cooperation, defense exercises. The Malabar exercise has been going on for, you know, almost two decades now. It originally was a U.S.-India exercise, starts to pull in Japan, then eventually Australia. You had a defense technology initiative that was pursued in the Obama administration, again in 2012 when you were in government, called the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative. And it was a really good idea, essentially trying to build this technology cooperation and pursue defense trade and U.S. arms sales to India. It ran aground because I think ultimately there was a dispute that the systems could never work out as to what the priority was. Was it trade or was it technology development? And each party had their own prior on this. So the process was a learning experience, I think, for both sides, and ultimately did not lead to the outcomes they had hoped. But there was a lot of learning in the process, and I think probably paved the way for some of the breakthroughs we've seen recently. So, for example, there was a long-time joint working group on aero engines and jet engines in the DTTI process. Never went anywhere, or it probably went places and then sort of ran aground. But last year, the U.S. government announced that GE was going to, that there was approvals for GE to build engines in India for F-414 engines that will be used to power Indian indigenous fighter jets, giving them sort of greater longevity. I don't think that process would have happened without the DTTI process. So there are, sometimes you have to fail a lot of times in order to sort of make the breakthroughs.
And DTTI was the Defense
Trade Technology and Trade Initiative. Okay. I think there was always a dispute even as to which word was prior, so I might be mixing it up.
It's okay. So there's this rich history of scientific cooperation. You mentioned a bunch of which I didn't realize. Industrial cooperation that's been going on. Plus, there's all of the, you and I are sitting here because of the people exchange.
That's right.
The you know, Indian people coming here, more and more Indians going back to India, Americans, and then a lot of business-to-business cooperation.
Right.
So then I guess this is why this makes it an ideal time to pursue something like Indus X. So, you know, what other things are you sort of looking at to say that this is the right time to do this?
Yeah, so I think there's probably some push and pull factors. Again, India's had this long-time demand signal. They want an advanced technology partnership. For the longest time, and during the Cold War, India believed it was only getting it from the Soviet Union. And even at the end of the Cold War, the Russians helped the Indians a lot when it came to missile development, when it came to submarine nuclear propulsion for submarines. Even today, one of the most advanced cruise missiles that India not only produces for itself, but also exports to some of our partners like the Philippines, is a BrahMos missile that's a co-development process between the Indians and the Russians. So they're pretty tied in with Russian R&D, science and engineering, but they've always wanted to work with us. And there's a lot of good reasons why it makes sense to do it at this time. The most obvious one being that we're both facing down a challenge of China that's become more assertive and aggressive on India's borders and amongst areas that we care about, including our partners and allies in the Pacific. And so we have
always think about
cause.
China facing the Pacific and coming towards us, but turns out they have other borders as
they
well.
They tend to pick fights with lots of folks, including the Indians. And it has been picking up since 2013, really since President Xi came to power, but it really became most acute in 2020. It was a major clash on the India-China border that resulted in the first deaths on that border of Indian and Chinese personnel in 50 years. So it was sort of a punctuation point in sort of declining relationship that then really opened the doors for greater U.S.-India cooperation. And then I think on our side, we've come to a realization, and it's most sort of evident through the National Defense Strategy, that we need partners and allies, not just in name, but in sort of functions, right? We need them for burden sharing in operations, burden sharing in defense industrial base and supply chains. So seeking partners that are capable, that have mass, like India, is an important element. And then on the Indian side, I think I mentioned this earlier, the defense sector has been sort of largely the public sector for decades. But the current government in India has actually been quite favorable to opening up to the private sector, both to the conglomerates, but also creating lots of opportunities for startups to come into the ecosystem. So that the opening on the private sector from the Indian side has also created sort of a window of opportunity.
So there's a history of this. There's a moment in time which kind of makes sense. So what are some specific examples of activities that are being planned or even underway already under Indus-X?
So I think there's a first stage of just procedural, how do we get our bureaucracies to work together? And one of the innovations of Indus-X that's different from DTTI is picking the right actors that are more nimble to lead the charge. So in the United States, it's OSD policy, I think, has been overseeing it, but ultimately this is gonna be led by the Defense Innovation Unit. which just has sort of, you know, more nimble transaction authorities and sort of engagement capacity.
So the Undersecretary of Policy is the notional lead.
But yeah, you know, sometimes I wonder who the actual lead is, but I think it is at least it is being gestated and conceived in policy, but I think ultimately the lead will be DIU is my sense of things.
Okay, if it's DIU, then there's a signal there, right? There's
I think
a certain
so.
Speed we're looking at, there's a certain
Absolutely.
New technologies we're looking at,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And it's tapping into India's burgeoning or well-grown software industry, those
Definitely.
Sorts of things, drones
Definitely.
And that sort of
yep.
advanced
Autonomy,
technologies.
Autonomy, robotics, right. all that. And then on the Indian side, what's also pretty novel is that they created essentially their own DIU equivalent called Indian Defense Innovations for Defense Excellence, which is also sort of a public-private kind of entity, partly owned by their Ministry of Defense and partly independent. So it's got a weird sort of authority as well. But that also gives it sort of a lot more ability to move with speed, to hire differently, to seed grants to innovators at a more rapid pace, and then to sort of scale from there. So I think those are going to be the just that procedural element, I think, sort of changes the way in which we approach defense cooperation, defense innovation cooperation. But there have been some pretty significant moves. I mean, this thing was basically launched less than a year ago. So from its launch in June to today, you've seen the notion of joint challenges being put on the table to DIU and IDEX issuing those challenges in a specific domain in underwater communications and domain awareness, and then awarding the winners of those challenges.
So the challenges were to industry.
To industry, yeah.
To provide to solutions.
Solutions to two sort of specific challenges on, yeah, underwater communication and domain awareness. They came from the service. So I think the Coast Guard was sort of the initial initiator from the U.S. side of particular challenges. Hmm. And the result is those awards have been given out, and there's going to be new challenges coming online. But I mean,
and contracts speed. Have been awarded.
Well, I think the first challenge awards have been given out. I don't know if the contracts have been awarded yet. The Indian system is still sort of probably working through like that speed. But I think it sort of presages the opportunity for both the challenge winners to collaborate with each other to pursue contracts, or to collaborate with primes or sort of other system integrators for those contracts to become a sub on a contract. So I think essentially what it is doing, I mean, the whole enterprise, I think, is about matchmaking, right? It's matchmaking between different parts of industry that have not been able to get into the defense supply chain or are coming up with new innovations that, major programs of record are seeking. So that I think the challenges part is an important piece of it that was awarded. There's a new thing that was launched in February at the INDOSEC Summit, which is basically a testing consortium.
So the INDOSEC Summit was a meeting held in...
So the first summit was held in June of last year in D.C. The second one just happened in February of this year in New Delhi. Mm-hmm. And so that was headlined by the Indian Defense Secretary and Indo-PACOM Commander Admiral Aquilino. But, you know, a whole bunch of officials from the Pentagon, from research and engineering, acquisitions and sustainment, from the services, from the Army, were there essentially to build sort of these connections with industry and government. And there they announced a new effort under INDOSEC, which is a testing consortium, which again becomes this opportunity for to sort of solve a gap that the Indian system particularly has, which is they don't have enough capacity for testing and certification and verification of novel technologies and prototypes. And so leveraging U.S. capacity for that, but also then making that testbed an opportunity for scouting by U.S. companies and program managers and governments. So I think that is the vision. The vision is on paper, and now it's about sort of execution, but I think that is the next stage of INDOSEC.
And I know that, in some of the rollout activities and some of the papers put out by yourself and by the department, we've called out some activities that are already underway. You know, I
yep.
think there was something about Penn State doing collaborative yep. research. What's that?
Yeah, so Penn State has been leading sort of this academic track with India's Institute of Technologies. They have a number of institutes of technology. And it's basically trying to sort of figure out what are the kinds of challenges that academia can work on together. I think it's still a work in progress. They've had sort of had the academic engagements track, but figuring out how you send faculty over from one department to another to sort of host them as visiting faculty or visiting researchers, sort of figuring out sort of what parts of labs they can access, not access. It's still sort of being worked out. But I think that's the vision ultimately. It's like sort of joint science at some level. So Penn State's been doing tremendous work on that. And then General Atomics is another player in the system, in the industry side, that has on its own kind of developed a template for how this could work. They built industrial partnerships with two Indian startups to I think sort of build a targeting chip and then probably sort of an AI process that would also be integrated into their MQ-9B platform.
Oh, great.
And so that platform, after they sort of built this partnership, I think there ultimately is going to be some degree of mentorship and technology and business development sort of collaboration. But ultimately that platform is basically going to be, it has been nominally purchased by the Indian government. So I think there are about 31 MQ-9Bs that the Indian government has agreed to purchase. And it's just a matter of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. But that is another template of how industrial collaboration between the U.S. and India can lead to profitable outcomes for U.S. companies.
So the NDIA membership ranges from large systems integrators and the General Atomics of the world through the whole sub-tier supply chain, medium-sized manufacturers, small businesses, a lot of new and emerging venture-backed software firms and robotics companies, and universities like Penn State. So, you know, in that, when you're talking to the NDIA membership, you know, why should they care, right? And about getting involved in
sure. ESX? Well, I mean, first, it's the bottom line. There's the potential for really profitable partnerships. I think the challenge that ESX has realized is that and you alluded to this earlier, the U.S.-India technology collaboration has existed in the commercial and non-government, non-defense space for decades. It's been immensely profitable for both sides, particularly in software services, but also chip design. 20% of the world's chip designs come out of India. So it's a hub of innovation and engineering that has just not been leveraged by the defense and dual use side for export control restrictions and sort of a history of different levels of trust. But I think if we can break through that, I think there, you know, first and foremost, there are profits to be made for industry and on both sides. So that's, it comes from sort of scouting unique technologies that come out of India and unique innovations, opportunities to invest in companies. There are a number of companies I've seen, it, particularly in the commercial space side. There are Indian companies that are producing satellites, doing launch, doing space situational awareness, propulsion.
There's really niche technology that can be harvested
everywhere, and they're doing it at a fourth of the cost of sort of, you know, of a lot of other engineering costs. So it's appealing in terms of labor arbitrage as well. And there's talent pool as well, like that you can access. So there's probably a lot of good reasons to be scouting this area. But then ultimately, from the U.S. government side, this is about building the strategic sinews of a partnership. I think there's a theory that's probably baked into integrated deterrence that extends to operations, but also to the defense industrial base, which is that the more that other partners have a stake and skin in the game in our sort of collective collaborative efforts in the rules-based order, the more they're likely to stand up and defend it. And I think that is ultimately part of the goal with all the enterprises that have to do with U.S.-India defense cooperation, including ESX.
So the other piece of the NDI membership that comes to mind is the actual government employees who are members of NDIA, and those are acquisition people, program managers, yeah, researchers. So how do they think about how ESX helps what they're trying to do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, again, I think on the research side, ultimately, this will be most successful if we can go from just the private sector to getting our labs to cooperate with each other and to do more joint science together, to work on programs together, but then sort of work in parallel and then compare and contrast. I think that another challenge for the U.S. government, particularly for you know, not just the policy side, but sort of probably acquisitions and sustainment, is going to be about resilient supply chains that are close to theater, that in the event of you know, our industrial base being sort of overtaxed or having challenges in terms of logistics of getting capabilities into the theater, having partners that are able to produce these things much closer to the edge of a challenge.
You're tapping into a partner that's a growing democracy, right? It's got this great software base. It's got this huge workforce that's trained, educated. It's a country with amazing resources. Yeah.
English-speaking.
English-speaking. Yep. And I guess I didn't think about that. It's in Indo-PACOM theater.
Right. Absolutely.
That's right? Why Admiral Aquilino shows up.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, those are advantages.
Right? Absolutely. I mean, if you think of sort of the term that another set of colleagues coined about a decade ago about what are the global swing states, the states that sort of have the capacity to tilt the balance of power just by dint of their own size and heft, India is probably the lead in that in terms of what it could bring to a partnership.
So then, so this is all happy.
It's positive.
But there's been a history of trying these kinds of engagements with India, and we talked about some of the successes, but we've also mentioned a couple of the challenges.
Yeah.
And so, especially with your background, let's walk through some of those that have been historically gotten in the way of us
sure.
working closely with India. So the first is this notion that we'll put it politely, attitudes towards working with the private sector mm-hmm. and towards dealing with the private sector and industry have been very different
yeah.
from the U.S. government
sure.
in the Indian side. Has that changed today? Is that kind of attitude in the right place now to really push these kinds of cooperative activities?
Yeah. So, I mean, it certainly has changed. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing some of the progress in Indus X. But undoubtedly, there are going to be challenges for a long time. I mean, India's defense industrial system, as I said, is still largely dominated by the public sector. It's the largest players. All the defense production units in India are owned by the government, and they're controlled under the system by the Defense Research and Development Organization that has had a monopoly on this for 70 years. And it's not that they're unfamiliar with dealing with sort of foreign partnerships and joint production, but their history of licensed production, particularly with the Soviets, but also with other countries as well, never really resulted in the transmissions of technologies that they had hoped for. In large part, the diagnosis is in large part because the private sector was not present in those exchanges. The most important thing we need is to have self-reliance in our defense industrial capacity. And the way in which we've gone about it, while it has sort of been focused on sort of the public sector dominating this, has not actually resulted in that outcome.
Right.
So we need to think differently about how we achieve self-reliance. And it might mean leveraging private sector right. partnerships, even with international partners. So it takes sort of it's a circuitous route, but I think they're starting to come to that conclusion. You're seeing it in policies as well.
Right. You touched on one of the other big, almost third rails here, the broader geopolitics is no political scientist like yourself, but it, my understanding, India has drifted from more alignment with the Soviet Union in the old days than with the U.S. into leading a non-aligned movement in more recent times. And today, playing maybe this role of a buffer or leverage against China. So, but it's still complicated.
Yep.
So are the geopolitics right at this moment?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think India will ever be an ally in the way in which the United States sort of sees allies in the Pacific. But maybe
it's
you
not
can,
Japan, it's not
Japan,
South
it's
Korea.
Not South Korea, it's not Australia. And I don't even want to use, it's probably like more like ally or partner curious, right? Let's put it that way. There's definitely a tilt that is evolving over the last few years, and that's due to both sides' efforts. Some of that has to do with sort of the challenge it faces with China. In 2020, when I mentioned I had this clash with China on the border, the U.S. Very deftly offered to help India in whatever India needed. India asked for some things. I think in the open source domain, we know that there was asked for intelligence information, so probably some satellite overhead imagery, as well as cold weather gear and probably some other materials, a lot of diplomatic and political coordination. And the United States was there to back India at every step of that. And it's been acknowledged now on the record by the Indian government and Indian officials. But it's taken some time for that story to come out. But given that, I think that India is sort of seeing that was a chance to test U.S. reliability. And I think the U.S. Demonstrated it was a reliable partner. And so I think India will start to seek more from the United States. Simultaneously, I think the U.S. sees that India can be a formidable partner in this concept of integrated deterrence when it comes to China. If the two countries can work together closely in whether it's a Pacific contingency or South China Sea or the Indian Ocean, the more dilemmas that China has to face, the harder it is for China to be able to sort of aggress opportunistically against a single actor. And so I think there's some sense that there's a common interest and sort of a mutual interest in sort of building that partnership.
And the other thing that gets in the way of international cooperation, not just with India, but everyone else, is the sort of regulatory framework.
Yeah.
So are you going to fix export controls? And are you going to fix trade barriers? And are you going to fix Buy America in this country and the equivalent in India? How are you thinking about all of those hard things?
Yeah, well, you know, it's such an easy problem to fix that I'm sure I can take care of it. No, I think, though, that there is an understanding that we've been focused on the problem for some time, but now I think there's a greater sense of urgency. IndusX is pushing the envelope on this, but so is AUKUS, right? I mean, there's lots of initiatives now where our old mechanism, old system of export controls can't be business as usual. I mean, we have to still maintain export controls. We're still, at the end of the day, worried about leakage to China, but there's probably a better balancing act that we can figure out, particularly when it comes to partners and allies. So I think with India, you're starting to see some changes that have evolved alongside IndusX about approval levels or approval rates for license requests that are coming from Indian companies or sort of in partnership with the United States. So I've heard statistics such that like about 99% approval rates for Indian companies that have submitted them. So that there's a question of like sort of who's submitting it. But once it happens, it seems to have high approval rate and it happens at a fairly fast timeline, faster than I think sort of the 60-day average that State Department estimates or that Commerce Department estimates. So there's some improvements in there, but there's certainly more things that could happen that have to do with, again, sort of speed of decision-making, sort of default processes that default to a yes rather than a no within the system. Maybe some certain domains where there's more room for exploration without having to get license approval for every single step of this. Just that, you know, it can keep pace with the pace of innovation to some degree. So I think the system is starting to work on these problems. I don't think they're solved by any means, but I think we're seeing progress.
I got time for one more question. So you've convinced me. How do NDIA members get involved if they want to get involved with IndusX? What should they be looking for? What should they be tracking? Who should they be talking to?
Sure. So I think the earliest entry points are there's a series that is run by DIU and NISN called the Gurukul series. It's in collaboration with the Indian IDEX. And that's a monthly series that should be, it's virtual, so it should be accessible to everyone. And these are about sort of how the U.S. Indian commercial sectors can just work together. And there's like,
and we can put a link to that into the.
Yeah. And I think companies will sort of get a lot out of just sort of those early series, including one that was about sort of navigating export controls on the U.S. side. There are summits that are going to be coming up in the future. I believe there's at least a financing summit that will be coming up sometime this summer. Because, I mean, another piece of this we didn't even talk about is sort of the joint financing mechanisms that will be in the venture capital that is necessary to drive a lot of these collaborations. There's paperwork that's put out, right? The DoD has put out several really detailed fact sheets on this, so it's good to sort of get familiar with those. But then the stakeholders that are a part of this process, industry organizations like the U.S. India Business Council, the U.S. India Strategic Partnership Forum, Indus Tech Council, our organization, USIP, we're putting out sort of analysis of, you know, both sort of what progress has been made, evaluating the challenges and sort of what are the next steps in this. But ultimately, I think what you're pointing out is maybe a gap that I realize that the whole process needs, which is sort of a centralized clearinghouse database, maybe website, and hopefully DIU or some other partner in this effort will collaborate, collect all this stuff and put it in one place. So it's just a one-stop shop for industry to identify what's going on.
Yeah, and then we've been happy at NDIA to be invited into some of these discussions to try to provide some of that information, to provide some of that dissemination of information back to our members and let our members participate in some of these activities. So, you know, it's great to be able to support you on this. With that, I want to thank Samir for joining us today and talking us through IndusX. I want to give a couple of commercials for what's going on at ETI. Our second annual NDIA Emerging Technologies Conference is going to be held August 7th through 9th, 2024 at the Walter E. Washington, D.C. Convention Center in downtown Washington, D.C. Visit our website for more information. Registration should be opening up in early May. Please visit ETI and NDIA's website to sign up for our mailing list and register for our various webinars, events, and educational offerings, including our monthly Tech 101 series. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all our latest content. Special big thank you to Melanie Yu and Daniel Park for producing this content. With that, I want to thank you so much for tuning in to Emerging Tech Horizons.